Good afternoon. Welcome to Robots at Red Tape. I am your host, Nick Schutt here. Happy to have my buddy Brian Drake here. Brian, how you doing today, man?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Dude, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Really excited about having this conversation. I feel like it's one that needs to be had more. But before we really dig into the meat of everything, do you mind just telling everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got here, man?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Brian Drake. I work at Accrete AI. I'm the federal CTO. I've been here about 3 years. I left a job at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Just prior to that, where I worked on a variety of different mission sets: counterintelligence, counter-narcotics, counterterrorism, emerging disruptive technologies. Did that for about a decade, and in that time, I was the director of artificial intelligence for 2 of those years. I managed about a $20 million portfolio across that. My last job in the Pentagon was as the leading the briefing team for the Secretary of Defense and the other E-ring principals, briefing them, running the team, briefing them on a daily basis for events of the day and long-term strategic work. Prior to all that, I was in management consulting. I did a lot of work at various places in the community. So I've worked for the FBI, NSA, USDI, DIA, CIA, and DNI. So yeah, been around a little while.
Yeah, man, all and a lot of big intel focus, really appreciate all the work you guys have been doing there. If you don't mind, man, would you tell everybody a little bit about why you left government to come back out and be in industry and just some of the things that you're focused on and thinking about now?
Yeah, so when I was in the private sector prior to going into government, I think the thing that frustrated me the most was, as a management consultant, you're working on these projects and you spend a lot of time trying to figure out like what are we trying to solve here? And you work on doing a bunch of research and you prepare some sort of decision document like slides or a white paper, and you think you come up with a pretty good solution. And then you put it in front of somebody who is a leader, your customer, and they got to decide what happened. And it was really never what you wanted. It was usually kind of like what was cheaper or easier and things like that. And I got frustrated with that and I wanted to be on the other side of it. So I decided to go into government because I wanted to be the person making the decision rather than being subject to the decision. I also wanted to kind of see projects through, right? So like, we might work on like a strategic engagement, but we wouldn't necessarily do the implementation. The government got to do that. And I thought it would be more fun to be on that side of it. So that's why I left. That's why I left the private sector to go into government to do that work. And I had a good time, met good people at DIA during that time. Still talked to a lot of them. And I got back out. And it's been a little bit different in the sense of like, I'm in a wholly technical role, and I'm in a position where my primary job is to take what we make in the commercial sector at Accrete and transition it into some sort of federal use case. So I get to have some free rein to explore topic areas of concern and kind of see what we can do, or at least explore it as a space. So that, to answer your other part of the question, what I'm looking at now is what we could do potentially in human trafficking and sexual exploitation, ways to identify pain points on the part of bad guys doing bad stuff, and what can we do to limit harm. Yeah, so that's my current focus area.
It's a phenomenal mission, man, and I think it's also something that a lot of people don't think about or talk about as much as we should, right? And so, can like at a 1,000 foot view, kind of what's the state of human trafficking operations globally, in what you see now, in addition to that, where are the dollars that are being spent to fight that and combat that generally going?
Yeah, and I'm really at the beginning of this exploration. So I've been interviewing quite a few people to get answers to some of these questions. And there's a lot of fairly reliable data, and then there's data that's wholly not reliable. And so everyone's kind of guessing. So for the things that I've uncovered so far, there are estimates that are anywhere between 27 million to 40 million people worldwide are trafficked. And trafficking can include things like forced labor, indentured servitude. It can include things like being forced into prostitution. Those are all part of that trade. It also seems to be co-located with a lot of other criminal activities. So if there is human trafficking occurring, there's likely drug trafficking occurring. There's likely money laundering occurring. There's likely weapons trafficking occurring. It all kind of follows the same logistics lines, and they all kind of adapt based on how, police forces, law enforcement, military forces adjust their strategy to stop it. So if you see like a big interdiction at sea for drugs or a border control area, well, that not only chokes down on stuff coming across the water for drugs, but it may also stop things like the movement of humans. I mean, so there's this really kind of interesting balloon effect, and that's why when you push it, it kind of goes in one direction or another direction. So the physical movement of folks has been an enduring problem for all of humanity, and forcing them into labor that they did not consent to do. That's been an endemic part of human history. What is different now is that it's much, much more online. It's much, much more digital. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children holds a lot of statistics on this. They collect a lot of data, and they're estimating that between 2021 and 2023, there's been a 300% increase in online enticement.
Wow.
300% increase. So, and that was mostly kind of spurred on by COVID. So when we all kind of went home, all those bad practices went from being kind of sort of beneath visibility in the digital space, and they went way into the digital space. So that trend continues to endure because it's cheap. It's easy for people to enter the space and start to make money off of it. And now with websites like Pornhub and OnlyFans, they're allowed to create a persona for themselves and do it in such a way that appears to be a legitimate form of entertainment, when in fact there's probably some sort of exploitative undercurrent to it that we don't fully understand. And that's part of the complexity of it as well, is that while we like to talk about consenting adults and things like that in these kinds of forums, that doesn't always exist. And it's hard to discern whether or not that's true. So that's why we have people in law enforcement to figure that stuff out. So I'm convinced that there's probably something we can do in this space, but I'm trying to figure out kind of what that is. And to answer your other question about kind of where that money is spent, just so far from what I can tell, most of the money being spent in this space is usually in the nonprofit space. It's usually oriented toward restorative care or harm reduction. So people who have suffered harm in being trafficked or exploited, and trying to get them services. And there's a wide variety of services that help people out in different ways. So a lot of funds go toward that. Very little, it appears, goes toward supply reduction efforts or trying to get upstream of criminal enterprises that are propagating it. So I'm more interested in that end of it right now. There might be some opportunities for harm reduction, but I'm really thinking about the upstream stuff right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would, obviously harm reduction is something we should continue to put dollars into. And absolutely, victims that have been going through these traumatic situations should continue to be supported. However, I agree with you. It's probably going to be far cheaper to avoid, prevent somebody from being trafficked in the first place than to take care of them on the other side, right?
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
yeah, no, absolutely. And so, one thing that you touched on that sounded really interesting is that it generally is in, like, I don't really know how to describe it other than the, like, criminal conglomerations. So once you, it sounds like once people have the ability to move illicit goods across borders, that they're just going to ramp up and do all of them, as opposed to, and I mean, to frankly diversify, right? Yeah, if you're moving people through the border, or drugs through the border, or weapons through the border, you're able to move things through the borders. Do you think that some of the funding that goes to things like reducing, illegal weapon sales and reducing the flow of illegal drugs has a trickle over effect on some stuff like this, on human trafficking? Or is do we really need more of a focus on preventing people from moving through?
It's a really good question. There is a bit of an effect that is correlative, right? Because you will have some people relying on the same route. So if you're moving like a truck full of people, there might also be other illicit goods like drugs or weapons or something like that. Not often. It's usually kind of segregated and separated. If you it can sit, it appears that the business models for a lot of organized criminal elements are more like consignment. So it's like this shipment is going to be cocaine, this shipment is going to be heroin. This shipment is because they have somebody on the other end who is the supplier of it, and that's how they do it. And so they treat humans like products in the same way. So you might be able to shut down maybe one coyote or one illicit shipment coming over the border. But there's a whole line of other folks that are willing to do it for the same amount of money, less money, just waiting behind them. Because when that market has a vacuum, it gets filled. And they can throw, the criminal organizations can throw all sorts of money at that problem. Whereas we just don't have, we, the US government, do not have those kinds of resources to infinitely fill the backlog, right? They've got a free market incentive to make sure that those goods continue to move. Law enforcement is limited in their budget, so they can only kind of go after what they can go after. And it is that visibility question, right? If you're in law enforcement, I've got to be able to see it. I've got to be able to affect an arrest. I got to know where a person is, how they're doing, what they're doing, ascribe intent, motive, guilt, all those things, and prosecute it in a court of law. That's a high bar. And so the bad guys use that against us. The funny thing about all this and why I think there's more opportunity in the digital space is because, yes, the physical world has, the digital world meets the physical world at some juncture. I'm fairly certain that the digital world is probably becoming more important to these folks because there are market trends beyond their control that are pushing them in this direction. Things like currency availability, right? Like I haven't carried cash for, I don't know, more than a decade. I mean, I've right, and I think that's kind of common for most folks. And even in the illicit market space, they're getting away from credit cards, period. They're moving into like cryptocurrency exchanges. So, and they've been there for quite some time. So they also have learned things like when they rely on credit cards and credit card bank transactions. Well, when we get wise to that, we just shut it down, right? We freeze the account. We call Visa or MasterCard and say, you need to cut this off. There's a lot of strings, but things in like cryptocurrency make it a lot harder to do. And so I think that trend, that 300% increase in online enticement, only captures a small segment of what we see into the future. The future is going to be more of that enticement. It's also going to be more digital transactions for currency.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's absolutely fascinating. And so, yeah, I mean, you touched on a couple of these now, but some of the challenges that law enforcement really has with the push to the digital trend, right? And the push to crypto is like, first, I know something that you mentioned when we last spoke is that you have like for a police officer to make an arrest in a if they see somebody getting picked up for prostitution, so they have to see money change hands. So yeah, I know that's like how are organizations getting around like that? But then outside of that, what are some of the but you know some like I know you mentioned budgets and the bar for criminal prosecution. What are some of the other challenges that are just out there for law enforcement now?
So yeah, there's several layers, and every situation is different, but there are some pretty common things that appear to be true. So one thing is those enticements, sometimes those are occurring over a social media channel or maybe a private chat like a Telegram or a Signal or something like that. That kind of happens. But there has to be an introductory phase or recruitment phase where well, for lack of a better term, the pimp has to get introduced to their prospective prostitute, right? So that exchange appears to occur more often across open advertisements. You'll find them all over the internet. But the advertisements don't say, hey, become a prostitute. It says something like, we have modeling jobs, or we have certifications to become a physical therapist, or we have something like that. And so you enter into that thinking that you're going to be a model, or you're going to be a masseuse, or whatever, or you're going to go work at a particular factory and it turns out to be a field. There's things like that. That kind of bait and switch happens all the time. And they often, the exploiters often target folks who are in distressed situations, homeless youth, orphaned youth, migrant workers, people who are not here in the United States legally, and they use that to exploit them. They'll also do some things like they may immigrate here legally, but then they'll take their passport, and so now they have no means of identification for themselves. And they're basically stateless, right? So what do you do when you don't have a form of identification? You can't get a driver's license, you can't get a job, and certainly you can't prove that you're here in the United States legally. So you're avoiding all law enforcement at all our costs, right? Because you're afraid you're going to get extradited. So they use those leverage points to keep them captured and often not paid. And so through all of that, law enforcement has a difficult time kind of discerning what's a legitimate business and what's not, because that advertisement for that physical therapy job might be real. It might not be real. You only know that after you start getting into the exchange. So they have to rely on victims presently to report this is a problem. Like I'm being trafficked. Well, if you have all these other things around you that are basically leverage against you, you're very unlikely to say, yeah, no, I'm being trafficked, because they know that there's maybe physical pain, intimidation that's behind that. And they know that they're under complete and total control. They don't trust the police either, right? So there's all those pieces of it. The other part is like getting someone who's to go testify in front of a jury can re-traumatize them, right? So, if you need a victim to attest in a court of law, I'm being victimized, and this is the person that did it to me. Well, you're facing a person that did a lot of harm to you physically and psychologically, and that is hard to mount. It takes a lot of courage to do that. You're also encountering people that are maybe a little ashamed of what's going on. Like they got tricked and they got duped, and now they get a little defensive about it. So in a court of law, a defense attorney will exploit that. They'll say, like, listen, this person's completely unhinged. How do you believe anything they say? Or from what we know about trauma effects, your brain gets very nonlinear. So like if you go through kind of a battery of tests, and you know how those tests are going, like an SAT, like that has a process, a linear process. You know how to go through it. But if someone is screaming at you the whole time, you're not going to remember what question one or two or three was. You might remember question one or question six, right? That's a trauma effect. And now amplify that 30 times. That's what these people are going through who get trafficked. So if you ask them on a stand, like, where were you on this date? What happened on this date? You're not going to remember, right? Unless you're looking at notes. And now the defense attorney has a new point to say to the jury, like, well, they can't even keep it straight. They got to refer to notes. So how do we trust this person? Right? It's not a fair way the system treats victims. So, I tend to think that the way to both do a better service to victims and to help law enforcement get at these other invisible layers of the crime, like using cryptocurrency and some credit cards and things like that, is to get behind that digital footprint. And once you start unpacking that digital footprint, then you start to understand what you can prosecute. And you probably don't have to put a person on the stand. You can just say, like, at a high level, I can see that you trafficked these people over this period of time, and you got all this illicit money. And I think if we were thinking about the problem a little more horizontally, like I don't just need to put a person in jail, but maybe I could go after non-payment of taxes, or I could go after, this was a clever one I got from a state and local government. I thought this was really, really an interesting idea. The social services, fire support services, right? So if you are running an illicit business, you have a storefront, and the storefront has to meet code, right? It's got to meet health code, it's got to meet fire code, it's got to meet labor laws and things like that. Well, there are inspectors for all that stuff, and so those inspectors can come into that building and say, listen, you can't have 20 people in this room sleeping. That's a fire code violation, right? And if until you fix that, we're shutting you down. Okay, so now what you have done is you've taken that whole store, and now you've taken it out as a node in that network. That's great. Now social services can kick in and say, okay, for these 20 people, we have these beds, and now we can start the restorative process for those folks and get them out of the system. You don't have to go through a law enforcement action with a police officer to make that happen. You can use things like the fire code and health services. I thought that was fairly clever.
Very good.
So I think that's interesting too. So how do you enable those people to identify this might be a problem, right? This building is over occupancy for fire code consistently. How do you understand that? Where do you get that information? That's the type of thing I'm interested in discovering.
It's fantastic, man. And yeah, it's fascinating to think of like additional ways, and whether or not you're able to turn the codes and code violations and shutting these different nodes down into a criminal prosecution of the people on top, it's irrelevant. You're able to positively affect those 20 people's lives in a way that they need. And then you're also, to put it in the terms the traffickers are thinking about it, you're lowering their supply of product, and they need to go out and replace that. How do you, as law enforcement, how are you approaching, how do you map this, like these nodes of folks? How do you go from like a street level all, move up? How do you kind of roll up that chain in this industry?
Yes, yeah, a really good question. So there are quite a few technical vendors in this space that service law enforcement in this way, and they offer a variety of different types of tools to do that. And I discovered one of these providers. It's called Tech Against Trafficking, TAT, and they track all of the technologies that are available in the market. So they have about 304 different technologies that they are tracking to then make people aware of them and say like, oh yeah, this addresses my problem. And it's a very robust list. What's interesting about that list is that when we start looking at where the investments are, it's not heavily into the analytic tools that we're describing, right? So to kind of answer your question in a roundabout way, there are not a lot of tools for law enforcement to kind of go through a lot of data to figure out what's up. Most of the stuff that's at least in this list, 20% of it is hotline data. It's like hotline services and things like that. So where to get services, where to report human trafficking, where to report forced labor practices, that sort of stuff. The next highest is supply chain work. So it's all like supply chain analytics, something that my company happens to do, but it's focused more on things like where is forced labor being used in a given product for a consumer. So if you're a consumer and you say, well, I have this widget, was it made in a forced labor camp? You can scan it, zap it, whatever, take a picture of it, and that references the database and says, oh yeah, sure, that's made in a forced labor camp. So now you know as a consumer not to buy it. So it's a very different kind of way. What I would like to see with those kinds of tools is be able to turn those into sensors. So if somebody says, I know trafficking is occurring here and it's reported through a hotline, that's a cool tip. That's a really important tip. Once I know that, then I can start to focus in other things and other sensors that might tell me that. So I can start to think about what are the open advertisements for this area? Like who is trying to recruit people in Omaha, Nebraska to join a massage class, right? Well, that's a front for this massage parlor, and this is the location, right? So then you start to build out that mosaic and you say, okay, so now what kind of modes of communication are they using? A phone number and email address. Do I track those things? Can I see those across the open web, social media, the dark web? If I see that sort of thing moving around, then I can start to indicate that now I have a person potentially who's answering that phone number, responding to those emails. So for law enforcement, that's a nice investigative hook because you could either subpoena phone records, subpoena emails, things like that, right? That gives them the kind of tools. I think what I want to be able to do is, on top of provide those little hooks, is to say, I mean, here it is. It's largely a manual process. Everything in this business is a manual process. Like once you start to identify, like, here's what's going on, now they have to go back to their office and they have to type up some sort of document, whether that's a search warrant or whether that's a report for what they found. Case notes, whatever it is, you got to do that. I want to automate. So instead of you having to say like, okay, now I've got a phone number and email address, and I need to go write up a search warrant, I'm going to use an LLM, large language model, to produce those reports in the format that the judge, the court, the district attorney, whoever needs it, and I'm just going to submit it. I don't have to then write it from a template every time and make sure the date and this, that, and the other. No, here's all the specifics I have. Here's the case I'm building. And oh, by the way, I've done my investigation digitally, and here's the whole audit log. Here's the whole process of discovery appended to the document. So if at any point in time a defense attorney says, "Well, I think that warrant was issued improperly." Okay, you can see all the work. I've got it all tracked, and nobody has to type it all. The machine just pushes all that out. I think
Right.
that would be.
Absolutely. No, 1,000%. You mean, taking the administrative burden off. We don't want, and I mean, I give this example about AI and generative AI in general. It allows, and how I use it, much lower stakes than these law enforcement folks, is it allows me to do the stuff, do the things that I am good at, right? And the things that I can't replace. A lot of that is, replacing my administrative tasks, whether it's writing something or writing emails or writing a blog or, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's removing that administrative burden. And I think that collectively, we as human beings should want our law enforcement officers focused on investigations, not writing reports and writing these things. And so if we could take some of that administrative burden off, and because when you start talking about the scale that you mentioned of, I want you to think, you said 27 to 40 million trafficking instances a year.
A year.
When you and I is that nat is that internationally or just here in the US?
That's internationally. Yeah, internationally.
Well, I mean, when you start talking about that scale, right? And then you talk about, I mean, we talk about, funding concerns and bandwidth concerns, and then not to mention, I mean, not to mention the fact that I believe that all these, somebody has to go and review all this seized evidence, all these documents, and the mental toll that takes on the person reviewing it and reviewing that evidence. We could automate a lot of that and take that burden off of folks. I think that would absolutely increase the efficiency that our, people are able to fight this.
Exactly. And just to kind of add some additional context to that. So the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children also produces these, they're clearinghouse, right? So they're funded by the federal government to take in data reports, mostly from large tech platforms. So think Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat. They report out to them a whole bunch of data about what they have. This is called the cyber tip line. And so, the National Center takes that information, processes reports, and then tips those out to law enforcement. Last year, they did 36.2 million of these reports, right? And some of that's really low-level stuff. So it's, two minors swapping inappropriate pictures, and that gets reported out. It's also some really severe stuff on the other end of it, right? So it's a full spectrum. But what is interesting is that 92.5% of those reports are foreign. They are not in the United States. So when you start thinking about the complexity of the challenge, most of it's occurring outside the United States, or at least being tipped out outside the United States. And that's the stuff that's known. There's a bunch of other stuff you can't locate, right? Because they're using a VPN or some other obscurant. You really don't know. But it is so much volume to go through. It's very difficult for anybody by hand to really process that stuff. So, and the incentives for the major tech platforms to report are completely on their side. So even if they see an illicit image, a pornographic image that they think might be a minor, they report it. So it could be a 22-year-old. They report it and they make it the National Center's problem. So the National Center then has to say, well, that's clearly not, you're wasting our time. But their liability, the big tech liability, is in not reporting it. So for them, it's, I'm just going to keep flooding the system. They push the system, push the system. And right, that's good for them. It's not good for the mission. The mission is what's suffering. And if we are asking folks to go through all of that stuff visually or by hand, we're not really using their cognitive power. And you as a person on the line who's just trying to get through it all, you just want like results, right? So law enforcement investigations, especially for like arresting like a pimp in a prostitution ring, they kind of stop there. They don't go further than that. Maybe they shut down one of those massage parlors. They don't go further than that. And they don't go further because it's investigatively intensive. Like I've got to go back through, interview all these people, amass all these reports, then move upstream of that and hope somebody flips. I mean, on it just goes on forever. And while that's going on, operating in the back of your mind is like, there's still people being harmed. If I don't take an action now, if I don't pursue this prosecution now, I'm still going to have a problem. And I've got it. I mean, I've got to stop it, right? So the impulse is right. It's just that the tools available and the methods used don't really enable us to move up strategically, move upstream strategically. So I think that there are some things that are being done that help in that regard, like being able to identify images using things like skin quantum, so you can see what before looking at the picture, the machine looks at a picture and says, yeah, that's probably a naked picture. And then they can do things like estimating the age of the picture. So now you're starting to take that large swath of information and cull it down significantly. So here's what you need to pay attention to. What that doesn't do is it doesn't help reduce trauma on the part of the analysts. So just as an example, the Innocent Images Bureau squad at the FBI, this is their job. They go through a lot of these reports and pursue criminal prosecutions. They have to rotate those people out every 3 months because they have so much stuff they're going through. It really messes with your head. There's really nothing, you really can't avoid it, that causes a psychological harm. We're just not wired as humans to see this stuff. So I can tell you, as a career analyst, I didn't know what was going on in a given account, if I was given a new account, for the first month. You're completely clueless. You don't know who to call. You don't know who to collaborate with. You don't know what to read. You're just trying to figure it out. In 2 months, you're starting to kind of get closer. You've met a couple of people, maybe gone to a conference or two, starting to read some reports. By the third month, you know what's up. Like, you are now productive. And that's exactly when these folks roll off. So highest level of human talent at the FBI, at least, is immediately pushed into something else just to save their psyche, right? Totally the right response. But if there's a way that we could keep those folks working on the target as long as they want to keep working on it and preserve their psyche at the same time, those are tools I'm also interested in exploring.
Yeah, 1,000%. Because if you, I mean, shit, even if you were able to just double that from 3 months to 6 months, you're getting 100% more time out of folks, and you're giving them, more time for productivity. And then also, like, as working upstream, like, all I'm thinking about is that, like, how many levels upstream do you need to get before things are overseas, right? Because it one, two, three, and then if you're local law enforcement, then there's a whole process of bringing the feds in, and how does that work? And then you got to work internationally, and that's, I mean, there's just a lot of it's there's a lot that goes into that. But also, how could we cut this off at the source, whether it's coming from Eastern Europe, South America, Central America, Southeast Asia, even here locally grown, how can we go about addressing the people and getting and arresting and taking down the kingpins and of these organizations? Is that even something doable, or will somebody just pop up behind them because there's a demand and we should attack it from a demand side?
I think you have to do both. And so, and again, my experience is mostly in counter-narcotics, but the thing that is every study that's ever been done about this area, that the most effective means to reduce illicit activity when it's a consumable good, whether that's what we're talking about for exploitation or cocaine or something else, is demand reduction. Like, if you are working on demand reduction, you have a much, much more effective impact all the way up the chain because it basically crushes the economic motivation for the cartels or whoever else is operating. So you have to do that. And I think there's a couple of people, at least in this space, that are working on demand reduction. And so it's more of like educational assistance to Johns that are procuring sex traffic work. And they believe, the Johns, they think that they're going into something that's a consenting relationship. It is not. In more times than not, it is not a consensual exchange. But they believe it is. So there are some interesting things that they were doing for educational awareness. Certainly, probably not resourced the way it needs to be, and definitely difficult to discover. So that, again, to me, is another opportunity, right? We don't have to enable law enforcement exclusively to do some of this work. We could also enable nonprofits to do some of this work, to say, you need to find locations of where, sex trafficking is likely happening, so you have an opportunity to make an intellectual intervention. Yes, good. We can do that. right? And if we were looking at things like information available from cell phone data, we would be able to see kind of where those folks are moving, where they're coalescing, where they travel. And you at least would be able to work a little bit more inside a locality to address those concerns. I think there is a whole nother level you're getting to, which is the complexity of it. Like, yes, there are international components. You are going to need some federal authorities, but there's a lot that can be done on the state and local level just to help people be aware of activity, avoid the activity, don't patronize the activity, report it out when you see it. And there are ways that you could do that if you were equipping those fire marshals and health inspectors and building inspectors with the knowledge of, like, these are the things to look for, and you need to look for them not generally here, right? Here, this building's a problem, right? And when they know that, then they can take more proactive action rather than kind of like scratching their head, like, why are there 20 people living in this room? You shouldn't, that shouldn't be kind of the question. They should know walking into the building, there's human trafficking occurring here. I've been told and tipped. I need to look for what that was going to look like, because now you have context, right? Every human needs context. They need to know what's going on in order to act on information. And again, I'm an intel guy, so that's how I think about this problem, is that I think this is an intelligence problem, because we need to be pushing to people that need that information, a context in which they can act. How do you do that at scale? I don't think you can do that with human talent. I think you can only do that with machines.
Yeah, I mean, at scale, 1,000%, right? Because, yeah, I mean, and you just kind of touched on it, but like, what kind of data are you generally working through, or working with as an analyst? Is it structured? Is it unstructured? And do you have like kind of a breakdown of what that looks like?
Yeah, so it's all always a mix, but so my company in particular, we specialize in unstructured data. So think about like just books, tweets, comments, all those types of things. We go through that sort of stuff and extract value from it. That is really hard. Structured content is not as hard, usually because it comes to you in like off a system, a telemetry system or a sensor, or it's a spreadsheet, right? That has things. So I know it has columns, it has rows, it has timestamps, right? That is a very easy machine learning kind of thing to do. So a lot of the things that are coming off of, for example, the cyber tip line that have structure to them because they get reported out from the system of the big tech providers, they are giving them that. The trick is it all comes in different formats. Instagram doesn't look like Snapchat, right? So if you are looking for a commonality like this IP is the same as this IP, you have to have a way to cross-check those things. And so the National Center has that, well, thankfully. But that makes your job a lot easier. It's like, oh, okay, so this particular IP is brokering in all of these different places. Great. And so now the report that you put together can say, like, I understand the full spectrum of what at least this one IP is providing. It doesn't necessarily tell you things like who is that IP, right? So that takes other data sources that are external to what's being reported that you have to bring to bear to do that. So that's the other thing that our company does fairly well, is that we're able to take information from lots of different sources and crush that down and present that. So you might have things like name variations or phone number transcription errors, things like that. We can take those, build them together, and say, here is the entity you're looking at. Here's a list of phone numbers that we think are associated with it. These look, they're different, but they might be the same. And when we see those things, we can say, well, that it probably is the same entity. Those are probably those phone numbers ascribed to it. And now you've got something you can act upon, right? So that's where I would like to be able to turn this toward it. So types of data sources. Yeah, so obviously those open advertisements are very, very helpful. The trick is that at scale, you've got to be able to pull back from them and say, what does a legitimate job announcement look like?
Mm-hmm.
If someone says, I want you to become a model, what does that look like? Who is advertising it? How is that all ascribed? Most of the time, if you're a legitimate business doing something like a modeling agency, you're probably going to be pretty well known. There's going to be a track record. There's going to be some sort of data in the public domain that says this operation actually is doing good stuff versus something that's just a flyer that's left, on a telephone pole and has just a phone number or like a, some sort of Gmail account. that would probably be some indicators, right? So just that's a very simple example. And there's more nuance that we could tease out of that, but that's the type of stuff I think we could start to bring forth and say, like, at least we're drawing a line between legit, likely illegit. Now, within the likely illegit, what do we need? What other data do we need to prove that's illegitimate? And it's just kind of following those little trails to find that stuff to then come back around. And I've said this before in many other contexts, previously on the Sable-Spiel program when I was at DIA, but like these people want to be found. They just don't want to be found by us. That's the trick, right? They have an economic incentive. So we're going to help find them, but they're not going to like what's on the other end of it.
Absolutely. No, a thousand. And we should be looking for them, right? And I mean, you look at like, some TV programs have done a good job, whether it's, To Catch a Predator or what have you, because that's a whole other aspect of this we haven't even touched on, is the minor aspect of it, right? Which is, between that and then, and then something that you mentioned, which I didn't even consider until just now, is like you talk about services like at OnlyFans, or I'm sure Pornhub has their own version of it, or whatever. There's a bunch of competitors, that are, how do you even begin to look at content that's created and uploaded to judge whether or not it is consensual?
Right. So the content by itself is not necessarily going to indicate it for you. And this is why I think the model needs to change, because viewing pictures tells you something has happened that likely is illegal. But there are criteria that at least the National Center uses, which will kind of separate, which does separate between, yes, it's a naked picture, but it's a picture of a baby in a bathtub, right? That's a family photo versus something much darker. So that those criteria exist, and one is illegal and one is not, right? It's that simple. But I think that on the other end of it, we are spending a lot of time answering that question off of what images come forward and less time on the question of what is the criminal conspiracy. And why I think that's important is because the illicit trafficking industry is getting wise to that, right? They know that if it is blatantly exploitation, they're going to get shut down. So they have to take countermeasures so that that isn't readily apparent. And unfortunately, these big tech providers like OnlyFans make it really hard to detect that at scale. So it's a paywall typically to see any content provider's page. And once you have the paywall, which could be like $5 or it could be $50, it just kind of depends on what the provider wants to do. You have to get through that paywall and then you can look at the content. Okay. So I do that. Is the content consensual? I don't know. The only way you would know is like if there was something else in each of those videos that made you think it wasn't, right? And now you have an investigative cycle. I actually think what is more diagnostic is the business relationship behind that provider. Sometimes that's publicly disclosed, sometimes it's not. So again, another area of exploration I haven't quite gotten into yet, but there are some civil cases and there is some data out there against those providers, which start to unveil that. And I learned this at this conference. I just had no idea. It was an example of somebody who was running a ring. It was an exploitation ring on OnlyFans. It was 12 different women and 13 different accounts. The provider put all the women on 1099s. Was making like $100,000 a month off of them and never paid them. Right? So that's exploitation. But they're all adults. So now what? Right? The law doesn't kind of accommodate a criminal charge, it's a civil charge because they didn't pay them. So there's this kind of weird, murky things that are not quite criminal, certainly not morally just. So what do we do there? I haven't cracked that nut yet.
No, and I'm thinking also about so first, that's fascinating. I understand. I'm fascinated by, the business. I'm just my serial entrepreneur brain, right? I'm fascinated by any business model. Like, so I've dug into it, and I understand that there's a whole market of people that, to your point, manage other people's accounts for them so that they don't have to, all they have to do is the talent piece and show up, and they don't have to post or respond to messages and all of these other things. And so but I also imagine, and I start thinking about the legal structures behind that, and like, how do you attack the, let's just say, the boring bureaucracy side on the administrative side of these businesses to shut them down? Because this guy has, 13 accounts all tied to one, like to one entity, or some multiple entities that are all pass-throughs that all roll up to another one. How do you start identifying some of those? And do you, and I mean, and then also back to the international nature of it, I'm pretty sure OnlyFans is held by a company based out of London or out of England somewhere. So how does, like, are we able to get data from them on that side to see who's managing these accounts, and then try to look for patterns there? Do you have any idea how we would go about that?
Yeah, so in that particular case I was just talking about, that was a civil
Okay.
procedure, and they did get they subpoenaed internal documentation, which proved that there was this conspiracy on the part of this one party. Not easy to do, right? Not easy to do. So that's not publicly available information, but we're going to have to reckon with, what do we do with these services? Are they something that can be legislated? Are they something that to regulate, or are there other things that we could do to expose information, to put pressure on them to actively seek out exploitative activities and shut it down? So we've successfully done that with social media companies. They definitely don't catch it
Somewhat.
all, but they
So
try, right?
they try.
They have squads, right? They have people that are going after it and trying, and they have tools they've deployed, and so you can't fault them for that. Could they do better? Absolutely, we can all do better. Without question. However, there gets a point where, when we're starting to talk about just the numbers we know about, right? Just the stuff that's reported out by the National Center, it's surface level. It's surface level. I am fairly convinced it's sizably more. And it's really around who's propagating it. How do you go after those folks? What are the leverage points? Like, and I think we may have talked about this before, but like, when I see things like this, like a criminal conspiracy, I kind of think the same way you're thinking, is like, there is a leverage point here somewhere. I think about a network attack kind of model. What are we going to do to attack that network to collapse it? That's how we did it in the counterterrorism world, how we do it in the counterintelligence world, counter-narcotics world. That's what we spend our time on. And once we got to that point, then we, pulled it all apart. And it took a long time, took us years to do that stuff. But once you got it done, you permanently solved a problem. It always kind of comes back, but sometimes it doesn't come back as fiercely. Sometimes it's gone entirely. Right. But that's what it is. So I don't think we'll ever eliminate this problem. Like I said, it's endured since the beginning of human history, but it is incumbent on us to try.
I agree. 1,000%. Like, I mean, but yeah, it has endured, right? There, I think we as humans are, like, addicted to bondage from you only have to look, if you, because like, when you take a broad view of history, right, and call the last 5,000 years, it's hard to find any group, whether for based on whatever location you're from, what you look like, anything that hasn't either been an enslaver or been enslaved or both, right? A lot of people, it's both. It's really, really hard not to find any groups that don't do that and haven't done that. And also, I mean, the colloquialism is, it's the world's oldest profession. Everybody knows what that means, right? So I don't know how we would even begin to tackle it at, like, thoroughly, right? But, doing something different and doing more, is absolutely super important. But then also, how do you even begin to attack the demand side of it, right? Because there are, it doesn't like there are people at every level of society that want this and want traffic to people, either adults or children. And you only have to look at like, you know, Jeffrey Epstein and what happened there to understand that it can happen like in royal families, it can happen anywhere, right? And then you look at, you know, I know we know Diddy's going through his is he's getting brought down right now, and he's in you know, he's in jail. Actually, I just read this, he's sharing a cell with Sam Bankman-Fried right now, which I thought was just interesting.
What do they talk about?
Oh man, I bet that's fascinating conversation to listen to. But you know, it's like it's one of those problems that, you know, I mean, it's same thing with like narcotics and drug addiction. Like you can shut down, you know, you can shut down, you know, you can shut down the OxyContin, go in and shut down and clamp down the OxyContin supply in this country, right? Which we have done pretty successfully, but it's there's a demand, and so something like fentanyl is going to come along and take its place. And then, you know, how are we going to examine that, you know, as a supply chain of where that's coming from? But unless you're going to address the underlying need, to your point earlier, there's a free market incentive to figure out how to meet that need. And the scarcer it is, the more valuable it becomes to meet that need. Prices are going to go up, people are going to be willing to pay more. And then, you know, wherever there's a supply, somebody or demand, somebody's going to step up with the supply. So how do we even begin to ta like I can't even imagine how do we begin to tackle that?
Yeah, I would think, and I stole this. I'm stealing this from another local government official, but he said something quite profound. He said, "What we need to do is create non-permissive spaces, non-permissive spaces." So, and I'm gonna Bob Ashley, if he ever listens to this, he's gonna I'm gonna go
Mm-hmm.
listen to him. But I said we were talking about that same Sable Spear program, which detected opioids abroad and keyed in like here's where they're being produced and tipped out opportunities to close down operations, all foreign focused, of course. And I was showing him how it all works, and we were doing a lot of press about it because it was one of our few very unclassified AI programs, and so he wrote to me one day. He says, "You know, I don't know if we should be saying all this publicly, because then if they know what we're doing, they're going to stop doing it." And now his argument, of course, was a source and method kind of question, which we tackle all the time in the intelligence community, which is like, if we tell them what we can do in a certain way, then they'll change their behavior and then we won't see it anymore. A little bit different here, right? If we're able to tell them, it doesn't matter what you do, we will know what you're doing, and we're coming for you. You've created a non-permissive space. And that was basically what I communicated to Bob, as I said, we want that to happen. If we are using intelligence for an offensive outcome and getting them to quit the business, that's a good thing. And so I think that with the right program positioned in the right way, with the right people that are actioning that those targets, you make non-permissive spaces, and now it's not you running to catch up, it's you making them run scared. That's what you want. That's what I want to enable.
Dude, I love it, man. I love it. I love what you're doing, because I completely agree that we need to spend more, we need to utilize this new technology, and we need to spend more resources protecting the most vulnerable people in the in our societies, whether that's, you know, children, teenagers, you know, people that are growing up that in very, you know, very poor areas that don't have any other options, or people that are growing up in areas like the one that we live in that's very affluent. But also, you know, whenever there's affluent, there's going to be people taking advantage of it, right? And so I think it's a huge multifaceted problem, man. But I love what you're doing. I love applying this technology to, you know, look at unstructured data at a mass level, and then I, you know, to better target law enforcement. And I love trying to find ways to take administrative burden off of them as well, man. Really appreciate everything you guys are doing.
Hey, we're trying to get there.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Before we end, man, is there anything else that you want to add? Anything we didn't address? Anything at all?
No, I think this has been really nice. This is the first time I've spoken about this topic publicly, so I really appreciate the opportunity to do so. We have a lot of work ahead of us, still a lot of research to do, and a lot of people to still get in contact with. So if anyone's listening and is interested in helping out or providing your voice to the choir so that we can make an informed approach work, please reach out through Nick to me. That would be spectacular.
Awesome. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to Robots and Red Tape, everybody.